Morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Morning. Morning.
Looks like we have everybody. Kathy's not able to join us today, but everybody else is here. So we're going to get started. All right, I'd like to call the meeting to order. The August 19th, 2021 pension meeting. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the May 20th, 2021 minutes. Were there any questions or concerns of those minutes? No? Okay. So let me just take a motion. Can I have a motion to approve those minutes?
So moved.
Okay, motion and a second.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. They stand approved. Okay, so as you can see, the agenda is quite short. We're just going to have an update on the pension and OPEB performance. If you remember last time, we had talked about possibly adding some other asset classes, which would obviously increase our risk. So we wanted to wait another meeting until the November meeting so we hear from the actuary if we wanted to increase the risk or maybe talk about, again, lowering our assumed rate of return. But we wanted to hear from the actuary, see where we stand, and see how much that could possibly cost the pension. So today's objective of this meeting is just to get an update from Marquette Associates. And again, we have Pat Wang here today to give us that update. So I'm going to turn it over to Pat.
All right, great. Thank you, Gina. And good morning, everyone. It's nice to see you, at least on camera today. But as Gina mentioned, a pretty abbreviated agenda today. What we'll do is run through the results, talk about some of the changes that we made during the quarter and also so far here in Q3, and then obviously give you the final numbers for those the previous fiscal year, which obviously Chiron will use as a part of their data to put together the next valuation report that comes in at the November meeting. So with that said, please bear with me for a quick second as I pull up my screen here. Let's see. There we go. Can everybody see that? See my screen there? Yes, okay, great.
We can see it.
Okay, great, thank you. So we'll start where we always do with the market environment. Again, you know, spending 5-6 minutes talking about what's going on in the economy, what's going on in markets to provide some context for how the pension performed and the OPEB performed during the quarter. And then we also have, as usual, an update through the month of July that will round out the conversation here shortly. But with that said, when we look at the U.S. economy, the key theme right now is, as we see it, is that we're in a sort of a transition phase. So if we think about where we've been in Q2, you can see up top here, we note that Q2 GDP growth came in at about 6.5%, so very strong from historical perspective, but it did come in below economists' expectations. Economists were more upwards of, say, between 8-8.5%, and the big drag relative to expectations was business inventory accumulation. That was a big detractor from growth that economists hadn't been expecting, you know, largely thinking that a lot of the supply chain issues that we talked about at the last quarterly meeting may have alleviated to some degree, but that didn't appear to be the case in Q2. As we look forward here in the top right chart, we're showing the bars are the quarterly economic growth numbers, where the fully colored in bars are actual data, but the striped bars are estimates moving forward. And you can see here's Q3, this first bar here. But as we head into the rest of this year in 2022, economists are expecting a deceleration in economic growth. In other words, the economy is going to continue to grow, but at a slower pace. And the big driver behind that is really the fiscal spending coming out of Washington. So in the bottom chart, what we're showing is fiscal spending or fiscal contribution to GDP growth over time, where again, the fully colored in bars are actual data and the striped bars are estimates moving forward. So you can see the impact from all the various measures that were taken last year and even early this year to support the economy, whether it be the ARP, CARES, stimulus checks, expanded unemployment benefits, and the fiscal support was, again, historic in terms of speed and size. You can see how it was multiples of what we saw in the global financial crisis. But importantly, a lot of that spending isn't necessarily an increase to the baseline. It's sort of one-off measures, again, stimulus checks, expanded unemployment benefits. So those things roll off over time. And when they do, you can see this contribution in the stripe bar set to decelerate pretty rapidly and then become a headwind in the latter half of this year and then in 2022. So we're in this transition phase where a lot of the recovery has been supported by the fiscal authorities, and now we really need to see a transition for the private sector to be able to stand on its own two legs. And when we think about the probability of that, obviously we have to take a look at, you know, how consumers are looking right now and then businesses again. So when we think about consumers, the amount of savings built up given all the stimulus is quite high relative to the pre-pandemic. So there's a lot of sort of, you know, dry powder or firepower, if you will, for consumer spending to continue to increase and drive the recovery as long as we see continued improvement in the labor market. And then secondly, hopefully these supply chain shortages will lessen or alleviate to some degree so businesses can ramp up their spending, their inventory accumulation in anticipation of the strength coming from consumers. So as things stand right now, as we head into 2022, again, the key themes are things are likely to decelerate, and this transition is set to hopefully play out and drive the recovery as we head into next year in the beginning and also the latter half of 2022. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention as far as the economy is inflation. You know, we talked a lot about it at the last meeting. The dynamics haven't changed all that much in the past, or all that much, excuse me, in the past 3 months. We've continued to see inflation come in a little hotter than we've seen over the past few years, given some of the supply chain shortages, some of the base effect with what happened with inflation amid the pandemic and the reopening. But importantly, the rate of change in inflation is starting to level out as well. So we saw the July report come out about a week ago, and it was the first time in a while that the year-over-year increase or the year-over-year change didn't increase and actually came in line with expectations. So a lot of these temporary factors, whether it be used car and truck prices that were really driving a lot of the inflation over the past few months, that has started to alleviate to some degree. And we've actually seen at the wholesale level that those prices have started to come down. And over time, that'll filter down into the retail level as well. So a lot of these temporary factors, again, seem to be alleviating right now. And then more importantly, from an expectation perspective, both economists, the markets, and consumers do think inflation is going to be a little higher than normal as we head through the rest of this year, but then slowly scale back to more historical averages. So those expectations are going to be very important to keep an eye on, because historically, we think about, again, going back to the 70s, one of the big things that drove inflation outside of loose monetary policy and things of that nature and changes in the workforce was expectations. So, you know, when consumers think higher prices are coming, they tend to buy now in anticipation of those higher prices. And that sort of drives things into a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy or cycle where, you know, higher prices are expected. So there's more demand now, and then higher prices keep coming and moving along. So expectations is a really interesting data set we saw the other day, where if you look back in, again, the 70s and early 80s, where there's a key question for consumers saying, is now a good time to buy, say, durable goods like cars, trucks, new homes, and things of that nature? The answer today is no, because prices are high. Whereas in the 70s and early 80s, the answer was yes, because prices are high and they expect them to keep rising. So again, it becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. There's a huge psychological component to it. Whereas right now, those expectations are very different than what we saw in that preceding period. So that's going to be something key to keep an eye on. If those expectations change, then inflation may become a bigger problem than the market and certainly the Fed is currently anticipating. We'll skip the global economy and just talk a little bit about market performance. I'll talk a little bit about the global economy when we look at equity returns here. but you can see a strong quarter from equity markets, particularly within the U.S., up more than 8% during the quarter. So a very strong quarter as investors continue to discount the economic recovery. Corporate earnings have been very, very strong relative to expectations, really supporting the growth that we've seen in equity markets. Now, U.S. markets were ahead of international developed and emerging market equities. A lot of that, we would argue, is due to the economic environment, really namely the vaccine rollout and economic reopening hasn't been nearly as successful outside the U.S. as it has been within the U.S. So that weighed on relative returns. So in other words, those markets made money, but didn't keep pace with the U.S. given those dynamics. You see in the U.S. bond market here below emerging market equities, actually slight positive returns or a reversal of what we saw in Q1 as interest rates stabilized and even declined a little bit during the quarter. And then finally, from an asset class perspective, real estate, so the data is not on this page because it's not available when we put the market environment together, but as I'll show you shortly, we continue to see stabilization in the commercial property markets, a pretty strong return by and large, just south of 4%. And then the individual manager in the pension and the OPEB fund actually did quite well on a relative basis, was up almost about 5.5%. So when we put all the pieces together, equities, fixed income, and real estate, as we shift gears here into the results, very strong returns from an absolute and a relative perspective. So with that said, we'll hop into the results as for the pension first. Here, so you can see on page 16 some high-level information, and then we'll get into the data around all these figures or all this text in just a minute. But the market value at the end of June was just shy of $151 million. There was an investment gain of about $8.4 million, and then the return during the quarter was 5.9% net of fees versus the policy index or the benchmark per the investment policy statement of 5.4%. So what helped during the quarter, in other words, what helped the pension versus that return was a couple of key things. Number one, most active equity managers within the fund outperformed their respective benchmarks. And then number two, as I mentioned just a minute ago, Clarion, the real estate manager, did very well relative to other real estate managers out there. Now on the negative side, or what was a little bit of a detractor relative to the benchmark, is that earlier this year, we implemented a slight overweight to emerging market equities within the non-US space, really for two reasons. Number one, they are much less expensive than US and other international developed equity markets, so they're cheaper. And number two, history would suggest that, again, as the economy continues to recover and we're in the early part of sort of this expansion phase, that those markets tend to do better. They tend to outperform their counterparts. So that didn't unfold in June and also not in July either, as we'll show within the update. So that was a detractor during the quarter. As far as fund changes, just to revisit some of the comments we talked about in May, one of the global equity managers, Schroders, that was in the fund for some time, their performance was admittedly disappointing. And we were looking to make changes within the global equity lineup to have it mirror what we have in the OPEB. But instead of cutting our losses and really selling low out of Schroders, we waited for a little bit, and they showed some better performance in March and then again in April. That then we liquidated that fund and made some changes to the global equity lineup, and I'll show you the details there in just a minute. And then finally, looking ahead during the quarter on August 1st, you can see here real estate was below its target for the pension and the OPEB. And given the stabilization and given how well Clarion's performing, given the current environment, we brought that back up to target on August 1st, you can see there. And then finally, as far as the infrastructure, I touched base with JP Morgan earlier this week, and they are still predicting that that investment will be made essentially at the end of this year. So we'll have a better outlook on the timing from that when we meet again in November. But as things stand right now, they still said the end of the year is a good target for that investment to happen. Now, as far as the data itself here, this is our executive summary page here. Again, tells us from a cash flow perspective, return and asset allocation, the most important takeaway data at a high level. So if you look at the second quarter column at the top left part of the page, you can see where we began at the beginning of the quarter for the pension at 142.8 $85 million. Some slight cash flows, and then you can see the large investment gain there. So when we sum those up, the fund itself grew by about $8 million during the quarter. And then for the fiscal year here, again, very important, we began at about $120.5 million, a slight cash outflow, but then an investment gain north of $30.6 million. So the fund itself grew by about $30.4 million during the current fiscal year. You see the returns here in the middle of the page. We'll talk more about this shortly when we look at the peer rankings. But before moving on, we also wanted to point out importantly that from an asset allocation perspective, for all the respective asset classes here listed on the left, their current allocations here shown in the first column, all well within the policy ranges as set forth in the IPS. So that's yes across the board, meaning that all the allocations are in line with the IPS as we ended Q2. Now, to highlight some of the changes that I spoke to earlier during the high-level information a second ago, there were a couple of key themes to changes during the quarter. So number one was rebalancing. As equity markets continue to ramp higher, we rebalance some out of equity markets back into fixed income. And number two, the changes to the global equity lineup. So more specifically, you can see here there's about a $4 million redemption from the Fidelity 500 index fund within U.S. equities. You can see a few lines below that. That's the liquidation of Schroders, that global manager that I spoke about a minute ago. Now, most but not all of that money went into the new global equity manager, AllianceBernstein. Again, this is a manager that's already been in the OPEB fund. And the residual redemptions from U.S. equities and then some out of international and emerging markets went back into fixed income again. So not just changing the global equity structure, but rebalancing after a period of strong equity performance during the quarter. Now, circling back to the returns, again, this is sort of the peer rankings page where we can slice and dice the data and show you how the fund is doing relative to a lot of other public defined benefit funds out there. A lot of data and information on this page. So the key takeaways are found in these bottom two rows where you see the circle and the triangle. Again, the fund was up 5.9% during the quarter. So that was good for the top 22%. Relative to all other public defined funds in this universe, whereas the benchmark was around the median. Year to date, given some slight outperformance again in Q1, well ahead of that benchmark, at least so far here, year to date and ahead of the median. And then again, most importantly, from an actuarial perspective, fiscal year to date, slightly below the median, but many multiples ahead of that assumed rate of return, which I believe is 7%. Is that correct, Gina? 7%.
Yes, that's correct.
So again, when there's some smoothing involved from the actuary perspective, we're not going to recognize all these gains from this 1 year in the next report. But given the fact that the return was almost four multiples of the assumed rate of return, that should have positive implications to the health of the fund, the funded ratio. And we'll hopefully see that in November when Chiron does their report. So I'll mention a couple of quick things on the investment managers themselves. Here you can see on page 32. So again, the fund was up 5.9% versus 5.4% for the policy. And pretty much all that outperformance was driven within equities. So you can see here the total equity composite. This is just a weighted average of all the US, global, and non-US equity managers was up a little bit more than 8% during the quarter, about a half a percentage point ahead of that benchmark. So within U.S. equities, things were more or less in line with the benchmark, even though we have some slight overweights to mid-caps here. You can see with the one active manager, Virtus Kane Anderson, and then a small cap value index. Even though those areas underperformed large caps, the one active manager, Virtus Kane Anderson, was ahead of their respective benchmarks. So they offset the headwind from having a slight overweight to small and mid-caps, which didn't do as well, by outperforming their respective benchmark. In the global equity space, you can see the weighted average of the four managers up 8.3% versus 7.2% for the broad global benchmark. You can see MFS here, they're the low volatility manager. In other words, what we expect from them is to capture most, if not all, that upside, but then really provide some downside protection. They were a little bit behind the broad global equity market here. You can see it's 7.2%. but ahead of their sort of investment process match benchmark, this minimum volatility index. So they outperformed. Artisan, our global growth manager, was a little bit behind. But then Dodge & Cox, the value manager, was quite a bit ahead. So when we put all the pieces together, having, you know, MFS and Dodge & Cox doing quite well, the new manager with AllianceBernstein, and then Artisan just slightly behind, that's where we get to the 8.3% versus the benchmark of 7.2. Now, on the non-US equity side, as I mentioned, this was a little bit of a headwind. Even though we have a slight overweight to value stocks within non-US equities through Hartford Schroders, and value stocks were a little bit behind here, you can see at 4.3 versus the broad market of 5.6, Schroders managed to outperform that benchmark. So they offset the headwind from having more in value by outperforming that value index. And then you can see below here, as I mentioned, the emerging markets index fund up about 4.4%. behind the broader non-US equity market. So this was the drag at the total asset class level relative to that benchmark. And then real estate, as I mentioned, for Clarion here, they're up 5.3% versus 3.7 for the benchmark. So a couple things notable for them during the quarter. Number one, they continue to run an underweight to retail and to the office sectors, you know, two of those sectors that are undergoing some structural headwinds given the pandemic and even pre-pandemic in retail, given, you know, what Amazon, the Amazon effect, if you will. So having underweights to those two sectors continued to help them. But also a big driver for them was they had previously written off a lot of their delinquent rents in the retail space. So taking a more conservative approach, just writing them off, suspecting that they wouldn't eventually come in. But the health of their tenant base in the retail sector improved pretty dramatically during the quarter. So those rents actually started to come in, and many of those tenants now are current. So something they wrote off to be a little bit more conservative earlier on, they were able to write back up as those rents actually started to come in. So a very strong quarter for them relative to the peer group, given those two factors. And then from a fixed income perspective, just to round things out here, you can see up 1.1% versus 1% for the benchmark. Wilmington Trust was slightly behind during the quarter, but given the three other fixed income managers within the fund, their respective performance, they were able to overcome Wilmington Trust's slight underperformance to leave all the pieces when you put them together from a fixed income perspective, slightly ahead of that benchmark at 1.1%. versus 1% for the policy index, the Barclays US Government Credit Intermediate Index. So with all that said, let me pause for a second. I've been talking for a while here. Any questions or comments as it relates to the pension before we move into the OPEB results?
Pat, I have a couple of questions. I noticed, I guess maybe this is more to Gina, the contribution listed for fiscal 21 was about $295,000. Is that right?
So,
or is that too low?
You want to take this one, Gina, or you want me to?
Yeah, I can take it, Dave. So, what happens is when we pay the pensioners straight out of general fund, so that's considered a contribution. What you're seeing, what he's reporting, is the actual money going into the accounts. But we're contributing based because of the way we handle it over here. Without, so that way it doesn't fluctuate our cash balances. So when they are investing, they got a number that's not going to move as much. That's how we handle it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And the Fidelity Emerging Markets Index Fund. I guess my question is, do you think it would be better to use an active fund for emerging markets instead of just an index fund?
So it's a good question, Dave. And, you know, one we're talking about. So the idea around the allocation originally was just say, we want emerging markets exposure, number one. And number two, the emerging markets index tends to be a little bit growth oriented. In other words, it tends to have a high allocation to information technology stocks, you know, similar to what we see in the S&P 500. So when we think about how all the pieces fit together, we still have some value overweights in the US market and in the international market. So when we look at the three managers here, We have a broad index fund up top, a value manager, and then within emerging markets, even though it's an index fund, given the composition of that is heavily weighted towards information technology stocks, which are more growth oriented. We like that complement when you put all three of the pieces together. So right now, today, we're comfortable with that. But moving forward, it would not surprise me if we do look to maybe swap that out for an active manager if we see a more opportune time to do just that. Is that helpful, Dave?
Yeah, that's good. Thanks, Pat. And then the last one, you mentioned infrastructure investment by the end of the year. I mean, with the new bill, passage of that new bill, wouldn't it make sense to invest sooner rather than later?
It would. Unfortunately, we're at the, I'm going to use the word mercy, which is probably not the right word, of the manager asking for the money. So this works like the real estate investment where the fund makes a commitment of a dollar amount, but the manager doesn't ask for the money until they're ready to invest it. So there's a little bit of a queue or a waiting period for when we get that paperwork done, which we did at the end of last year, until they're going to call the money, which was a year's time. So we don't determine when that money gets invested per se from a timing perspective, but we expect to happen by the end of this year. Then they ask for the money and then it'll be invested into their infrastructure fund.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so let's skip ahead to the OPEB. And by and large, the takeaways will be the same, so we won't spend nearly as much time here as the pension, but a couple of key highlights to take away. So at a very high level, the fund was about $60.5 million at the end of the quarter. We had an investment gain of $3.3 million. And then you can see the return here, 5.8% versus the index of 5.4. So now that the two funds are invested pretty much exactly the same from an implementation perspective, moving forward, any differences will essentially just be rounding due to if we have cash flows or maybe the relative allocations within the managers themselves. So that's why the pension was 5.9 and the OPEB's just 5.8 in Q2. But the takeaways as far as what worked and what didn't work, the same as we talked about during the pension discussion. But from fund changes, we did make some changes, but not in the global equity space, but within fixed income. So what I'll show you shortly is that when the OPEB fund was smaller, Wilmington Trust was the sole fixed income manager. But as the fund has grown over time, the number of or the amount of money that they've been managing has obviously grown in sympathy with that. So in order to provide a little bit more diversification within fixed income, we pulled some money out of Wilmington Trust and implemented a few other mutual funds that pretty much mirror what we're doing on the pension side in order to, number one, again, have a little bit more manager diversification within that segment. And then number two, give us a few more levers to pull, if you will, when we need to rebalance, not to just have to rely on adding money to Wilmington Trust or pulling money from Wilmington Trust, but having a few other places where we can essentially execute any rebalancing within the fund itself. And then as far as looking ahead, same as the pension. So we added to the real estate fund on August 1st, and then that infrastructure capital call we expect to happen at the end of the year. So from a cash flow perspective, again, up top, you can see during the quarter, we began at about $56.85 million. The little bit of money coming into the fund, again, and this is a similar story, Dave, to the pension as far as those dynamics of funds moving in and out. And then the net investment change of $3.3 million. So when we put those pieces together, the fund itself grew by about, you know, $3.6 million during the quarter. And then fiscal year to date began at 47.8. You see the cash flows and then the investment gain of $12.4 million. So the fund itself grew by about $12.8 million during the past fiscal year. Again, we'll talk about returns here in just a second. But the asset allocation, much like the pension, all the respective asset classes in line with the IPS allowed ranges. So as far as changes, again, similar story as the pension from a rebalancing perspective. You can see rebalancing out of equities. Obviously, the numbers are smaller here because the fund is a lot smaller, but rebalancing out of equities as they went higher. But below here, you can see the fixed income changes. Again, taking some money out of Wilmington Trust and implementing a few new managers for the reasons I outlined a minute ago. From a return perspective, again, here, the two key lines are at the bottom. So the total OPEB fund at 5.8% was around the top quartile. And now year to date, 9.7, I'm still around the top quartile. So the OPEB, again, just to reiterate or review, in Q1 did a little bit better than the pension, given the global equity managers were a little different at that time. Now they're the same, but given that Q1 relative outperformance of the OPEB relative to the pension, the year-to-date number's a little bit higher here. And then you can see the fiscal year-to-date a little bit higher here as well, but again, almost four multiples higher than the assumed rate of return. So again, hopefully we'll see the positive implications of that when we hear from Chiron at the November meeting. So as far as the managers themselves, the takeaways are all the same as those for the pension that I walked through now that the implementation is pretty much similar across the board. So with that said, let me pause here to see if there are any questions about the OPEB before we look at the July performance update. Okay, so bear with me please for one quick second as I attempt to bring up the update. Oh, that didn't work. Let's see here. Here we go. Okay. So for July, you know, pretty much more of the same that we saw in Q2 as far as the takeaways and the themes. So for the pension in the month of July, the fund was up 1.1%. versus that benchmark of 0.8%. Year to date now through July, this is calendar year, up 10.6 versus 9.7. And for the month, a lot of the same themes that I talked about a second ago, where the total equity composite was ahead of the benchmark, largely due to outperformance within the US and global space. Whereas again, like I talked about earlier on in the beginning, the non-US equity was a little bit behind because emerging markets haven't been performing like we expected. But that again was really the only key detractor, and we put the pieces together in aggregate equities well ahead of that benchmark, driving the outperformance. As far as real estate's concerned, that's reported on a quarterly basis, so we don't have the numbers yet for real estate for the month of July. And then fixed income, more or less in line with its target. Again, a little bit underperformance from Wilmington Trust. Therefore, the rest of the managers within that segment offsetting the underperformance that we saw from them during the quarter, or during the month, excuse me. And then finally, for the OPEB, again, similar story. 1 month return up 1.1% versus the policy index or benchmark of 0.8. And now year to date up 10.9% versus 9.7 for the benchmark. And again, you can see these returns mirroring the pension almost to a T here. The total equity composite up 1.3 versus 0.9. And again, that largely driven by outperformance within U.S. equities and global equities, whereas non-U.S. was a slight detractor. Again, real estate, don't have the data yet. We'll have Q3 numbers when we meet in November. And then from a fixed income perspective, again, a similar story, Wilmington Trust slightly behind, but the new managers that we implemented in Q2, again, offsetting that relative underperformance from then, leaving fixed income as a whole more or less in line with the benchmark. So with all that said, that is that pretty much concludes the remarks that I have prepared for today. Again, happy to answer any questions or comments from the committee about this or anything else going on in markets.
Pat, I have one question. Yes. Do you have any concerns about Wilmington Trust consistently performing below their policy index?
We do. You know, we do. You know, Wilmington Trust is a manager that is very conservative in the sense that they don't make a lot of bets, if you will, over time. So their performance tends to be below the benchmark by their fee, right? So they track the benchmark pretty closely, But then when they have fees of 15, 20 basis points, if they're in line with the benchmark, then it's going to result in underperformance net of fees. So that is something we're taking a look at. I asked maybe a question in response to you as well. I know Wilmington Trust is a Delaware-based firm, it's a strong relationship with the county. So I don't know if that should come into consideration as we think about that, or at all as we think about that decision.
Agreed. I mean, having somebody in Delaware is important, but right. I mean, and looking at 5 years, 3 years, 2 years, I understand they're more conservative, and that was the answer for multiple times when we're doing well and everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe there's a discussion we have about their fees.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Gina, I didn't mean to interrupt. That was one of the reasons that we made those changes on the OPEB side as well, since they were managing all the money. We took about half of it away to add these new managers. So trying to alleviate the historical underperformance that we've seen moving forward. But, it's something that we have been talking about. And I think a discussion maybe better suited offline about some of those other dynamics, if we have to consider them or not.
Right. Understood. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think it's, I don't know what you think, Pat. I mean, isn't it important to have in fixed income a fairly conservative base? And since it's really security, there's not much return, but they're investing in treasuries. You're not going to get much. You're not going to earn much.
You're spot.
Especially short term.
It is. So, at the total
high, and they certainly need to look at that.
You're spot on, Dave, in isolation, there's not a heck of a lot of income in fixed income these days. But if we think about the rest of the structure here, so if we ignore Wilmington Trust for a second, we have a decent allocation of treasury bonds that, there's not a huge income to be had there, but we think of that as sort of the insurance, not just within fixed income, but within the total portfolio. So even if we say moved away from them, the way we would implement it would still be relatively conservative, but our expectation then would be we would be able to perform hopefully at least in line, if not slightly ahead of the benchmark, probably at a similar fee. So that would be the ultimate goal if we ended up moving away from them.
Well, the treasury bonds are intermediate, so you do have some interest rate risk there. But I think the Wilmington Trust is more short-term, as I recall, isn't it?
It's intermediate as well. So like you said, Dave, these are intermediate treasuries. They're a little longer. So Wilmington Trust would be operating in sort of the 2 to 10 year segment. These treasuries are 5 to 10, but then we complement that with managers that focus on the 1 to 3 year space. So when you put those three pieces together, being treasuries and these two short-term managers, then your maturity or interest rate risk is more or less in line with the benchmark. So we're not super, super long duration or interest rate risk because we have the treasuries, because we offset it with the short-term managers that just operate in that 1 to 3 year segment.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments that I could answer today for the committee?
All right. Thank you so much, Pat.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. So that is the end of our agenda. So can I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
So moved.
Do you have a motion and a second? All right. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right. We're adjourned. Thank you.
Thanks.
Take care, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pat.